This is the audio from a recent Institute of Economic Affairs YouTube video. We've stripped the audio so that you can listen on the go.
For the moment, without doubt, people have to accept the paternalist principle that government should stop people from making choices which are bad in order to support this policy. And once that's accepted, I think it's just a runaway train to banning all sorts of other things.
And you just think, when you're arguing with somebody and they're claiming putting council tax up by 6% is keeping it down, you just know you can't win because they're not rational.
Hello, welcome back.
We are back again. It's the Swift Half with Snowden, with me, Christopher Snowden, the inventor of the half-hour television programme. And we've got six episodes coming up for you in the coming weeks. Let's get started, because as you know, if you've seen the show before, we've only got half an hour. I'll set my timer here. This week's guest is Charlie Amos, who writes on his Substack, The Musing Individualist. He is a libertarian doer. We need more doers in our movement. And has been particularly active recently opposing the generational tobacco ban. Charlie, thank you very much for sparing your time. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Chris. Thank you for having me.
What do you think the prospects are for liberty in this country at the moment? Looking good?
I don't think they look at all good. And particularly when it comes to paternalism, it seems the politicians have on the whole accepted the paternalist premise and they're just driving it to its logical conclusion. They're not all the way yet, but they're getting there with the ban on smoking.
Indeed, they are. Now, what's your sort of your philosophical background? Who are your big influences?
Well, unlike yourself, I'm not a utilitarian. I'm far more of a natural rights libertarian.
Yeah,
a proper libertarian. So,
enough.
Robert Nozick, Murray Rothbard, mm-hmm. Eric Mack, Ayn Rand. These are the thinkers that I go to if I'm in need of philosophy.
And you are pretty pure libertarian, I think it's safe to say. I like reading your blog because I know I'm always going to get a down-the-line North Star of real sort of Randian, Rothbardian libertarianism.
That's right. I think I would describe myself as an anarcho-capitalist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Taxation is theft. The state is nothing of a gang, but the thieves are at large. That kind of thing.
And do you think that cuts through with many people? Is it useful to make those arguments just because they, even though they're totally, you know, unrealistic as political propositions, let's face it, is it useful to make those arguments to kind of root things in some kind of sound philosophy, as you say?
Well, they're unrealistic only in the sense that they're not politically achievable.
Yes.
Today.
Yeah.
But I do think it's worthwhile making those arguments because I believe they're the real arguments for liberty. I don't believe we should believe in liberty because it leads to the best outcomes, and often liberty won't lead to the best outcomes. Now, am I going to say taxation is theft to somebody in the street? No, because it's not typically going to move the ball forward that much. Mm-hmm. But if I'm writing an academic essay or I'm writing my blog, then I will put forward these deontological principles and not the utilitarian ones that the IEA and the Taxpayers Alliance and the Adam Smith Institute typically put forward.
Well, I would say we put forward both. And I kind of disagree about, you know, liberty will often produce bad outcomes. I mean, firstly, you know, by whose lights, you know, who's to decide what a good or a bad outcome is. But I don't think I would be a, quote, libertarian if I didn't think it generally produced the best outcomes, or certainly better outcomes than any alternative. So what kind of outcomes are you thinking of which are suboptimal under your system?
Well, my system doesn't really deal with the whole idea of suboptimum. It's not a error in my system of thought that it leads to suboptimum outcomes according to a utilitarian standard. But if we're talking about a utilitarian standard, I'd say the public goods problem is one that libertarians would really struggle to overcome if they're strictly adhering to self-ownership and property rights. Policing, for example, although I think that could be provided very well by the private sector, I think it is manageable in many cases to see the public sector delivering a better service because it can tax people. And when I say a better service, one that is socially optimal according to conventional economics.
Which brings us nicely on to your current campaign to stop the tobacco ban. Let's first of all talk about why you're opposed to it. Obviously, I'm opposed to it as well. Neither of us smoke. But for you, it's a real big issue. And you think this is a real fork in the road, sort of crossing the Rubicon moment? Because I do.
I think it is, because without doubt, perhaps that's too strong, but I'm going to go with it for the moment. Without doubt, people have to accept the paternalist principle that government should stop people from making choices which are bad in order to support this policy. And once that's accepted, I think it's just a runaway train to banning all sorts of other things. And even if those other things aren't banned, the principle is accepted, which would allow for the ban of those things to be coherent within the mind of the general population. If
and even if they're not banned, but we have a lot of hyper-regulation of it, then people go, well, at least it's not banned. Could be worse, could be like tobacco. At least it's not banned. So there's sort of Overton window element to it as well.
Which I think is a real shame. And that's why I think it's so important to make case for individual liberty. And that's why it's the first point on my campaign banner, on my campaign leaflets. We've got to defend individual freedom. What's next? Are we going to ration alcohol and fast food or require exercise? I really do think these things follow from the acceptance of the paternalist principle, which is people should not be free to make bad choices.
I think what probably irks me about it more than anything else out of a wide field is there isn't any pretense anymore that this is just trying to stop the tobacco luring people in, or it's to correct some sort of market failure. In the past, we've had all sorts of anti-tobacco legislation just in the last 15 years. There's always been the excuse for it that could be sort of defended on sort of neoliberal-type grounds, right? So the smoking ban, we're protecting bar staff from secondhand smoke. The advertising, we're stopping the industry from manipulating people's minds, plain packaging, the same kind of thing. Display ban, we could keep it out of sight. We're not stopping people buying it, but it'll just be behind shutters. Taxes, there's negative externalities. But with this, it's just, we don't like smoking. We don't think anybody should do it of any age. It's not, this is not about the children. A lot of this regulation has been about the children. You know, plain packaging, it's to stop kids from smoking. Menthol bans, kids like menthol, and they don't anyway. But you know, there's usually something of the children element to it. And with this, there isn't. I mean, they're still talking about children, interestingly. They're still painting the idea of the 14 and 15-year-old and hoping that people won't sort of have the mental agility to work out that those people are going to be 24 or 25 in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
But it's flat-out open paternalism. And that, I think, is the most dangerous precedence being set.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think a number of members of the public that I've spoken to are just quite happy to accept that. Although some of them have this weird habit of saying, I'm in favour of the tobacco ban, but I'm not in favour of rationing fast food and alcohol and requiring exercise, even though they'd admit that that is good for people. One woman particularly annoyed me, and I pressed her on this. I said, well, you can't accept the tobacco ban on the basis of paternalism and then not also accept rationing junk food, alcohol and requiring exercise. And she said, and I quote, oh, I'm totally chill about coherence. And I was just dumbstruck. I thought, well, I can't argue with you if you're not going to accept that one thing leads to another and that other thing is unacceptable, so the initial principle is unacceptable too. I just didn't know what to say. I don't know what to say. And she walked off.
She is the only person who stumped you for words.
I think that is the case.
So tell us about the campaign then. So you've been out on the streets of various places in London.
Yeah, I've been out on the streets in Westminster in London and then also in East Grinstead and Haywards Heath in Sussex. And I've also gone to Dorman's Land as well. And I've been giving out leaflets, but primarily collecting signatures for my petition. The petition's now got 307.
Here are the leaflets. 307?
307. Good. That is significantly more than the national petition, I'm pleased to say. It's not
quite as many as I got for my leap year petition.
No, not far. Not. Well, I think you've got a bigger media profile than myself, so perhaps it's a little easier.
Now, would you like to show us the banner that you've been taking out on the streets of Britain? It's quite a big banner, folks.
It is quite a big banner.
But all the watch out for that light, all the better for making a point.
So here is,
you can't see the top of it. It says, defend freedom, stop the tobacco ban. Three reasons to oppose a tobacco ban. Restricts individual freedom. What's next? Banning alcohol, rationing fast food, and requiring exercise. Two, it will make people who genuinely want to smoke worse off. Three, it will put thousands of people in the tobacco industry out of work. Could you just pop it to one side, yeah, Charlie, and we'll discuss this in greater depth? It's not ruining the studio. Good man.
Thank you for bringing that in.
No worries.
Well, it's falling on my head. Now, this fell on the child's head, I heard.
That is right.
When you were in Hang Receive.
I didn't want...
I think it's coming again.
I didn't want to tie it up against a gutter, because that gutter, I assume, was privately owned. So it had to be propped up simply by its own supports and a dictionary, a very heavy stone. And on a few occasions, it fell over, and on one of those occasions, it hit a child's head.
But only like it hit my head there. It wasn't hard metal.
No.
A child's skull.
No.
Good.
It's very light. And the mother wasn't too pleased, though.
Yeah, well, think of the children.
Exactly.
These are the main points. You say it make people who genuinely want to smoke worse off. In what way? Financially? Or
because it'd probably save them money, because the pack of cigarettes these days on the black market is £5. A legit pack is £15-16, isn't it?
It will save them money, but they will lose all of the pleasure they get from smoking.
Oh, if they quit as a result. You're assuming they're going
to quit. Assuming they quit. And I like to, when I'm fighting this campaign, just assume that it's going to work. That's why I don't
really shouldn't.
That's why I don't mention black markets. I think the moment you start talking about black markets, you're implicitly conceding to the paternalists, because you have to say, at least implicitly, just assuming that getting rid of smoking is a good thing. This ban will not work because it will allow for a black market to develop, which actually is not going to be conducive to your aim of eliminating cigarettes. In fact, it's going to do the reverse. I would much rather confront the tobacco ban head on and say, if it works or it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. It's restricting individual freedom. That's wrong, so it shouldn't go ahead.
Fair enough. Yeah, that is fair enough. Although, you know, again, the sort of consequentialist argument that this is going to be a criminal problem. If you look at what's happening in Australia at the moment, the firebombings of tobacconists and so on, you know, normal civilians are getting pulled into this kind of stuff, as they did with prohibition, as they do with the war on drugs. So there is a sort of quite a strong negative externality argument about prohibition.
I think the issue in the free market movement, though, is that people make too much of a point of that issue. I was at Taxpayers Alliance event on this recently, as were you, and they made a real point about the black market being an issue, and very, very few points, or they really didn't say much, about individual freedom. And yeah, I think the fact that they were making such a great number of points or pushing the black market so much meant that they were implicitly accepting the paternalist side.
Yeah, right.
Or if somebody was watching it, they'd think, oh, well, you want to get rid of tobacco. It's just you don't see a very good way of doing that being the tobacco ban.
Yeah. No, that is right. You do accept the premise. I think the same is true, actually, with the vaping debate. You know, that a lot of people on the liberal side have been more than happy to make the argument, the public health argument, saying, well, this is helping people quit, and that's fantastic. Whereas we should really have been at least stressing as well the fact that you don't need any justification for people vaping other than the fact that they like doing it. You know?
Yeah.
And if a non-smoker wants to take up vaping and they're a grown adult and they're reasonably well informed, there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't do. Because now we're getting to a stage where, well, look at what Rishi Sunak's doing with vaping, you know, clamping down on that, taxing refillable e-cigarettes, banning disposable e-cigarettes. What do you think is driving Rishi Sunak on this stuff, by the way? Have you any theories? Because it just seems to be him more than anything else, right? Well, it wasn't like there was this wasn't in the manifesto under Boris Johnson, and Boris Johnson was fairly paternalistic on the food stuff.
I don't know. I don't know what is driving him. And it's especially strange that he's clamping down on tobacco now, given he stopped the ban on buy one, get one free deals.
Yeah.
And even mentioned that consumers should be free to consume lots of fast food if they really want to.
Did he explicitly say that?
He mentioned consumer choice or consumer freedom. He definitely rested his opposition to the ban on consumer choice.
Right.
Consumers should be free to choose.
Do you know what his vice is, by the way, his main vice?
It's Coca-Cola.
Yeah, and his main hobby as well. It's on his CV has been what he likes drinking, and also his hobby is reading about the Coca-Cola company and so on. But he hasn't got rid of the sugar tax, sadly. Anything else to say about the generational tobacco ban?
Well, so give us a bit more of a feel of your vox pops and your encounters with the general public. What kind of percentage are on your side, would you say, the people you're bumping into?
It's very hard to say because I think people that agree with me talk to me at a greater rate than those that disagree.
Selection bias.
Exactly.
Good point.
I got 70 signatures recently, and I count for opposing the tobacco ban, and I counted in a little tally about 26 people that were actively against myself. So that would suggest that it's about 3-1 in my favour.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that, though.
No.
Because the people that are opposed to the tobacco ban will just walk past me or say no, or I don't want to speak to you, or something like that.
Yeah.
But there are definitely strong opinions on both sides. I mean, both sides will have very firm proponents, and it'll just seem obvious to them that, of course, the tobacco ban should go ahead, or obvious that, of course, the tobacco ban should go ahead. And what I found that really annoys me is that a number of people will say, my mother died of this, my father died of this, my friends died of this, and they'll take that as reason enough to back the ban.
The ban, yeah.
And I just think, well, that's not reason enough. I mean, really, it's irrelevant. I assume what they're getting at is that people shouldn't be allowed to make bad choices. Although when you put it like that, then they wouldn't agree with it.
Yes, indeed. So have you had much sort of aggressive opposition? Do people come storming up to you saying, how dare you defend the tobacco?
One person.
Just the one.
One elderly woman has come up to me and said, you're all pig-headed and ignorant. She was not too pleased with me defending the tobacco industry as she saw it.
Yeah. Have you been accused of being funded by the tobacco industry?
Yes. Somebody has come up to me and said, are you funded by British American Tobacco? And I said, well, I wish I was funded by British American Tobacco, but I'm not. This is all self-funded and quite expensive when you include parking and leaflet costs and things like that.
Yeah. Well, bless you for doing it, Johnny. Are you planning any more?
I might do a few more in Oxford if I can get a few of my
friends
to come along and give out some leaflets.
That should be interesting. I imagine they're probably quite pro the ban in Oxford, aren't they? I would think.
I mean, you would have thought it would be a haven of social liberalism, and as a result of that, they would be opposed to the tobacco ban.
That's not how liberalism works anymore, Charlie.
I think they would be very much against it. People being free to smoke, that is.
Yes. Well, we are living in dark times. Let's talk a bit more about your life. Of course, IA Intern of the Year, 1 year. What year was
2019.
And then you were president of KCL Conservative Association
for about 2 months.
Yeah, I've got a news story here from Raw, which I guess is a student paper. This is from 19th of May 2020, in the depths of COVID, in fact, isn't it?
Yep.
KCL CA president wants to scrap the NHS, privatise all education, and have more black tie dinners. And then I've got a story from the same paper exactly 7 days later saying Charlie Amos removed from the KCL CA presidency. What's the story there? Did you want more black tie dinners?
I made a number of comments about feminism and private coven communities, which have dogged my employment prospects for the last six months as well. I said third wave feminism should be bashed, and if people wish to associate on ethnic grounds in private coven communities, they should be free to do so. And those comments were seen as unacceptable by my fellow committee members, and as a result, they got rid of me. But contrary to the newspaper saying it was a unanimous vote against me, it wasn't, because I voted against them getting rid of me.
Right. So there was one person who stood up for yourself.
Yeah.
That was you. And that exactly. was the end of your political career. You were involved in East Grinstead Council, weren't you?
They got rid of me from the Conservative Party as a result of that. And then I became leader of the opposition. But I was leader of the opposition of one person, that being me.
Right.
And
so at least you can say what you want.
I could say what I want. And I was very pleased to actually go along to a council meeting that was discussing the budget and say, council tax is theft. And they got very upset about that.
Mm-hmm.
I kept on saying to them, stop threatening people with prison for not paying for your flower gardens. And they got very irritated about that. They said, oh, we're not threatening people with prison. And I thought, you are threatening people with prison, because if people don't pay this council tax bill, you're ultimately going to put them in prison.
Yeah.
But they would not have that, which I think is a real shame. If you're a social democrat, which basically they are, you should admit, yeah, we are willing to put people in prison if they don't pay for flower gardens or Christmas lights or
other
public services of...
How long do you think you could get away with pretending to be a conservative for? I'm surprised it didn't rumble you a bit quicker.
I was very good in the lead up to the campaign. I kept very quiet. They said to me, I remember on the campaign trail, don't talk about lower taxes. And I said, okay, I won't talk about lower taxes. But they made the fatal error on their part of saying, we wish to keep council tax down. And I thought, oh, well, that just means I can impose all expenditure now because they can't borrow money. So any increase in spending has to be met by an increase in council tax, really. Mm-hmm. So I opposed every item of spending and they got very annoyed about that. But what annoyed me more than anything else is that when they put it up by 6% in the first year, and I said, well, you're not keeping council tax down, direct quote from the manifesto, they said, oh, no, we are. And I was in a meeting with the mayor and the leader of the council arguing, you are not keeping it down. And they said, no, we are keeping it down. And then they would say occasionally, oh, we're putting it up by 6%. And I go, there you go, up. And he said, up, you said up. But they just wouldn't have it. And you just think, when you're arguing with somebody and they're claiming putting council tax up by 6% is keeping it down, you just know you can't win because they're not rational.
Orwellian.
Well, absolutely. They've redefined the language. Up means down and down means up.
And what are the KCL Conservatives like? Are they a slightly sounder bunch or not?
Oh, much sounder. I think you'll find that student Conservatives are far more economically liberal,
yeah,
and indeed socially liberal, whilst association Conservatives, who are typically older, are socially illiberal and economically illiberal too, comparatively speaking.
And do you think that's a result of the sort of pragmatic compromises that come with relatively high office?
No, because these people are in parish and town and district councils.
Relatively low office.
I think a number of these people aren't really too interested in being Conservatives. They're simply interested in being on the town, district or county council. And as a result, if the Conservatives are in power in that area, they'll sign up to the Conservatives and they'll bring along their social democrat values. It just seems to be the case that most people agree that the state should do a lot of things and taxes should be correspondingly high as a result.
It certainly does. It absolutely does. And that is the problem. But, you know, strong arguments to be made against that.
And that's what I do on my blog, Amusing Individualist.
You plug the blog as well. Do subscribe to his blog, folks. What do you like doing in your spare time, Charlie?
I like reading political and ethical theory.
Sound.
Watching Top Gear, doing Airfix models. That's when I feel I really don't have to do anything that day. I might do an Airfix model. Spitfire, Mr. Smith, Hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
I did a Fokker Wolf recently. I thought that was quite good.
Very nice. Are you ever going to get back into politics, do you think? Or do you think it's not really the place for people?
Isn't it for me? No. Because you have to compromise too often. I don't want to do that.
Do you think there's any point in having a libertarian party in Britain?
Yes. If that libertarian party is simply promoting libertarianism as opposed to trying to win office.
Yeah. Well, it's got no chance of winning office. I think the point of the Libertarian Party in America is to basically every 4 years you get a platform in which you can go on about how you shouldn't need to have a driving license and stuff like that.
Yeah, which I think is silly. I think you should have to have a driving license.
Found a bit of statism in your last.
No. You're exposing people to undue risk if you don't have a driving license. I mean, well, strictly, you don't need a driving license. If you were competent enough already, I think you could go on the road without a driving license. But given, I think people would be right to demand, well, I want to see that, you are in effect do need a driving license, although it could just be going through a test. But it doesn't really matter that much because the private road owners could require driving licenses anyway.
Of course, the roads would be private, so it's their rights, yeah.
Although there would be rights of way down some roads, I imagine, because there is room for common property within libertarianism. It isn't all about private property. Billy Christmas is a great book on this, Property and Justice, which I'd recommend people read.
Yeah, all right.
Do
you think doctors, or do you think people should need a medical license to practice medicine?
No. If you can do whatever you like
beware.
To yourself,
mm-hmm.
Why can't you allow somebody to do whatever they like to you, provided the consent is entirely voluntary?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some issues there, but I think on the whole, if you can do what you like to yourself, why can't you get a doctor to do what you like to?
And of course, there is no consent. Going back to this public health stuff, there isn't really any consent for the nanny state, is there? I mean, it's a remarkable issue how rarely these policies appear in party manifestos. I mean, as we just mentioned before, this generational ban wasn't in any party manifesto. Even the smoke-free target, which Theresa May just devised in the dying days of a minority government, was never in the 2019 manifesto. I'm pretty sure it wasn't in 2017 either. Plain packaging, I don't think, was in manifesto. The smoking ban way back, we explicitly said in the manifesto, we will not
apply to private clubs.
This to private clubs and pubs that don't sell food. So it's hard to argue that even on a sort of macro scale, people have voted for the party who said they were going to do this. They're not even doing that, let alone getting consent for individual policies.
Although polls say that the generational tobacco ban is popular.
Yeah.
Although if you look at some other polls, the one by Forrest, for example,
yeah,
then it's unpopular. But I think that might be because Forrest said, if an 18-year-old can do A, B, and C,
mm-hmm,
do you think they should be able to smoke?
Yeah.
And when it's presented to people like that, they go, oh, well, I would be a bit incoherent if they could say they can do A, B, and C,
sure,
but not smoke tobacco.
Sure, but it does show that if you phrase the question differently, and I don't think the Forrest survey was particularly misleading. Basically, the Forrest survey said, do you think you should be allowed to smoke when you're 18 years old?
Yeah.
Essentially. Whereas the other surveys that the...
Oh, did they ask about, do you think...
They specifically mentioned 14-year-olds and, you know, so do you think a 14-year-old should ever be allowed to smoke? Which is, yeah, it's exactly the same policy.
Yeah.
But as I said before, I think people just get, once they get this idea of a 14-year-old, they find it difficult to imagine that person getting having agency. You get two very different, I should explain for the viewers, two completely different results. You know, you get 70% in favour of the ban if you mention 14-year-olds, and about 60% or 70% against it if you just say, should 18-year-olds have the right to smoke?
Thereabouts.
Mm.
I suppose that's good news for us in some way. That,
yes,
when you phrase the question explicitly and make it very clear, then people still favour the liberal position,
mm,
which is people should be free to smoke cigarettes, even if that's bad for them.
I really genuinely think that a huge number of people don't get what this policy is about. I think they're asked a question, they don't give it a lot of thought, there's no real salience to them, and they go, yeah, fine, smoking is bad, therefore I'll support this. The number of people I've seen now who've been sort of saying, a point which I thought was incredibly obvious, right? I got interviewed by the BBC on the day of the announcement, and I said, as you do in these interviews, you say lots of things, and they pick 10 seconds to get on the 6 o'clock news. But the bit they picked was me just saying, well, this is just going to mean that in 20 years' time, you've got 33-year-olds can smoke and 32-year-olds can't, which is not even an argument. It's just me explaining how the policy works,
yeah,
right? And they thought that was the thing. And people saw that and said, that's a really good point. And I'm like, well, that's just what
the policy...
I mean, this is the inevitable consequences of the policy. And I saw, I think, Nick Robinson on his podcast, he was saying much the same. He's going, I don't think people have got the fact that in X number of years, these people won't be able to smoke and these people will. It's going to be really weird. So like, yeah, it is going to be really weird. I think by the time people realise how absurd it is, it's going to be far too late. And the next stage, and the final question, because we're up to a half hour, the next stage, I think, is they will then say, well, this is a bit of a daft system now, isn't it? So let's just ban it for everybody. And I think they'll do that within 10 years. Do you agree?
Yes.
Yes. There we have it. Folks, thank you very much for watching. This has been The Swift Half. Thank you, Charlie, for coming on the show. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Do keep in touch with the IEA, iea.org.uk. Make sure you like and subscribe our YouTube channel. And if you want to give us some money, then that would be very welcome at iea.org.uk/donate. Take care. See you next time.